Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Because our price point at $195 a bottle, that's a lot of money for somebody to spend on a bottle of wine. If somebody isn't playing at the highest level and our wine's not worthy of that $195 and I've disrespected my customers' dollars and the work hours that they've had to put in to earn that money by not giving them something worthy of that $195, I'm upset. And I won't allow any member of our team to take a day off and think, oh, well, I can mail it in today. We're just not going to go that way. My level of energy and intensity is too high for that.
Wow. First of all, highlighting your loyalty to the consumer. You've just described what I think should be at the forefront of anybody's mind who are in the industry that is about delivering the final product to somebody's in somebody's hands. In your case, it's a bottle of wine. But starting with the consumer and sort of reverse engineering your mentality as to what would yield the ultimate result.
What? I end every release letter with thank you so much. I'm living a dream because of your support. As soon as you forget, and it goes back to those people that are trying to be esoteric, if you don't remember that the consumer allows you to stay in business and to be successful or to try to be successful, you're going to be a failure.
No wonder people... there's probably very little attrition, if any, on your list. No wonder people love you. Obviously, your wines are fabulous. We'll talk about them in a minute. But that philosophy, I think, is, you know, what should permeate any business in any realm. And the fact that you're so acutely aware of that makes me very happy. And I think anybody who's listening could take heart in that.
Well, I sold dental equipment that wasn't always the most popular equipment. And you learn to be thankful for your customer base, and you make sure you never dishonor them by giving them something less than what they deserve.
Wow, that's fantastic. Let's talk about your mentors a little bit. I know you mentioned three of them, but there had to have been other people along the way that shaped your vision and your practice.
Greg LaFollette easily was my most important mentor. Nobody comes close to the gifts he's given me. He explains things in such basic manners, in such a basic way, that are such complex matters that he has this amazing gift. And to this day, if I'm not sure about something or there's something new that I'm approaching, I'll call him and just get his advice on the topic. He has been a difference maker like nobody else. He's just a genius. And then I, from him, got to know Virginia Lambrix. And Virginia really helped me focus on my farming practices. And I remember before I met her, there was an article in Wine Business Monthly about her. And the first line was, there's many people in the wine industry that believe Virginia Lambrix is a witch. And I read that and I'm like, I'm going to meet this chick. And we became very, very good friends. And, you know, she taught me how to think like a grapevine. And
wow. You that is witchcraft.
Well, a vine has to be stressed enough to focus on reproduction and making flavorful grapes. If a vine's too happy, it doesn't care about making flavorful grapes because it doesn't feel like there's any risk to its existence. Once it's stressed, then it decides to go reproductive and put energy into making thicker skins and more flavorful grapes. And she really talked to me a lot about the balance between those vines and then how to create stress by pulling leaves at certain times and running your canopy and your wires certain ways. And you have to get in the mindset of, okay, I'm at this site, I've got these weather conditions, what do I need to do to think like a vine to make myself produce flavorful grapes? You got to think like a grapevine.
Wow. Anybody else that had an impact?
Bob Foley up at Pride, his early wines in the 90s were so good. And just going up and barrel tasting with him, and every time I'd say, oh my God, this is so good, you're such an amazing winemaker, and he'd always look at me and says, no, it's the fruit. And yeah, it's the fruit. And all of these people talk the same way. You go up and you talk to Philip Tony. I was looking at a vineyard near his property a couple years ago, and he says, you know, they've got the second best grapes on the mountain after my grapes. My wines are so special because of where my vineyard's at and in the fruit. Everybody who makes truly amazing wines, so when you listen to them talk, they understand it's the fruit.
Robert Parker once referenced Philip Tony as part man, part mountain goat.
Absolutely. He is he is one of the most insightful, fabulous men I've ever known, and when he speaks, I always make sure I listen.
Wow. You've worked with quite a number of clients in addition to your own brand, which gave you an opportunity to work with the varied pieces of dirt, as you refer to it, and different sorts of fruit and varietals. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, the one vineyard that I begged for, the Hain Vineyard in St. Helena, 100-year-old Zinfandel. Turley made the vineyard famous with their Turley Hain Zin. And when the Chase family was developing their own brand and they were going to make some changes, I begged Katie Haynes Simpson to let me make her wines. I think I called her, texted her once every 3 days for 6 months, begging her to let me work with her vineyard. I would have done it for free. I wanted to be the current caretaker of that piece of land with those ancient vines on it. And there's only so many vineyards that are history, and this vineyard is history. And you walk it, you feel these ancient vines, you feel their soul. And to be able to now that they're at their tail end at 115 years of age, be the person who's responsible for the farming decisions and the winemaking, it's absolutely awesome. And I cherish it. Every time I go out to that vineyard, I walk around and I giggle. It's like, holy crap, do I really get to do this? It is an absolute dream come true. And if you don't get excited by your vineyards, I think it shows in the wine. Wine knows when it's loved. It knows when its dirt's loved. It knows when it's loved.
Russell's being modest, but you've made wines for some really famous brands in Napa Valley. If you'd like, you can mention a few that really helped you hone your skills as a winemaker and, you know, maybe even offer some revelations along the way.
Well, you know what's even more fascinating to me is I'm looking now at where I started. You know, we've had some interns that have worked for us that are now making their own wines, that are making fabulous wines. We've got two people on the winemaking staff now that are making wine, Michael Saviano and Caitlin Hertzler. And what's awesome is I never want to hire somebody to be on my winemaking team who doesn't someday want to have their own brand. And watching these young, incredibly bright people take fruit that you've been working with as well and craft their own examples. And both Michael and Caitlin this year made wines from the Tench Vineyard, and all three of our wines are so different, and we used similar styles, but they're just completely night and day apart from each other. And it's awesome to be able to help the next generation come up and make their wines and show them what you would do, and then let them take their own pathway and see what happens. And the future of Napa is bright. Most of this valley is about to be replanted over the next 10 years because of red blotch and some of the other bugs that are out there. And I think the farming practices are getting better, and there's so many really bright young people who want to make wine here. The challenge is grapes are now so expensive that there's not a lot of opportunity for them. They need to find entry-level vineyards and work their way up. And There's so many hungry young minds and so little fruit that that competition will ensure that the best and the boldest and the people willing to make big moves are going to get to the top.
Good news for the consumer. They can certainly be assured that what's coming out of Napa Valley, particularly under your mentorship, is going to be top-notch. Even, there's a lot of complaining about pricing going on, but there's a validation that you just offered that's important, that it's worth it.
Well, people should be complaining about pricing on a lot of wines because there's a lot of mediocrity coming out of Napa. But for instance, I have one vineyard that I work with where it last year it cost me $197 per bottle for the grapes. Oh. I'm selling that bottle for $195. So I start at $97. I add in my production costs, I add in bottling costs, I add in everything else. I'm at somewhere around $130 a bottle, and then I have to pay the interest because it's 18 to 24 months before you sell it after you make it, and then I've got carrying costs and everything else. And people think there's a lot of money being made at $195 a bottle. Not every bottle.
Wow.
There's times when it's tough to not raise your price over $200, and people think, "Oh my God, you've got to be making a fortune." We're pretty bare bones. I mean, you're sitting here in this winery that we designed. We have no tasting room. There's exposed beams everywhere. There's no lavish art. I mean, we run very lean, and there's not as much money as people would think right now in super premium Napa wines.
How do we help consumers determine what they should be spending their money on?
It's tough. You know, I'm glad that I've been blessed to be part of tasting groups and mm-hmm. gone to lots of big trade tastings, but there's so many small brands out there trying to go through the minefield of mediocrity is absolutely a nightmare. You can spend $60 on five different cabs at your local wine market and not come up with one really special wine. It's tough. I think consumers need to identify with a critic or two and then hope that those critics have palates that they can align their palate with mm-hmm. and then extrapolate what they're reading into what they're purchasing. And that's tough because so many of the critics out there are so different. Just look at Wine Spectator. James Labbe over the last 5 years has given, I think, under 10 wines, above 96 points.
Wow.
There's another critic who last year gave 46 wines 100 points in Napa, and they're tasting the same wines. And so you can't, as a consumer, look at every critic. You really need to find one or two who you can read and respect and follow, or else you're going to be lost. Following Seller Tracker is a combination of hundreds of people's different palates, and you don't know who most of these people are and what they like or don't like, and it's an amazing tool, and you can look at the average and glean quality from there. But reading individual notes, unless it's somebody you follow all the time, how do you know if what they think is excellent you're going to think is excellent?
We're so biased as humans, and certainly each one has a palate, and that palate is valid. So I think it's a matter of exploring your own, isn't it? And really taking the trouble, the time, and the effort to find out what you like.
And either that or find one or two producers you love, and ideally it's more than that, and buy those consistently and enjoy them. And when you want to fill in other things, if you're in the mood for Riesling, you know, go out and explore and buy some great Riesling or Champagne. But, you know, my cellar is full of Marcuson, Sine Qua Non, Realm. I've got a third of my cellar is Champagne and Riesling. I buy wines from people who I know are fabulous craftsmen who are dedicated to making excellence, and I stick by it. I buy Jeunesse Vieille-Vigne from Châteauneuf-du-Pape. I buy Mortoray Rendebois. I buy Pigalle. When it comes to Bordeaux, I buy Chateau Palmer. I have my favorites there, and I continue to buy and support people who create excellence. Leah Villas-Casse. I do the same in Burgundy. And so I I've found people who I believe are talented craftsmen, and I follow them. And between all of the regions I love and everything I drink, I drink a great variety of things, but they're all from people who believe in excellence.
So you practice what you preach, so to speak, the advice that you gave, you live. And none of the producers that you mentioned make wines that could be in any way described as timid. Tons of personality, to say the very least. So you're attracted to that style of wine.
Yeah, if you're going to spend a couple $100 on something, there should be personality with it.
Has there been any bottles over the years that completely rearranged your head?
I remember my first bottle of Marcus and Chardonnay, realizing, okay, this is different. I remember my very first Keller Trockenbaren Auslese. That wine absolutely made me stop and say, oh my goodness. Victoria and I had a bottle of 88 Chateau Palmer. We were having dinner and it was the two of us, and 88 was a really good vintage. It wasn't an awesome vintage, but we opened the wine, we cooked a steak, we started drinking the bottle, and I was like, is this as good as I think it is? And she's like, yeah, it is. And we actually just pushed our food away, and everybody who knows me, pushing steak away isn't something I do easy. And and we sat there, and we just talked about the wine for about 45 minutes and powered through a bottle of 88 Chateau Palmer, and we bought it at Haskell's in Minneapolis, and I drove to Haskell's the next day and I bought every bloody bottle they had. Wow. Yeah, I think everybody has epiphany wines where they're like, oh my goodness. The Cinquignon Against the Wall made me realize what domestic Syrah could be like. I was at Kevin Wood's house and he opened an 89 Haute Brion, and I took my first sip and I got emotional. I was like, oh my God, I'll never make a wine like this. It was just so ethereal. If a winemaker doesn't have a list of wines that inspires them, they shouldn't be making wine.
Thank you for sharing that. And you're clearly known as a red winemaker and arguably maybe a Cabernet to most folks that know of you. But you've described quite a range, anything from Burgundy, I mean, varietally, you've really tapped into a lot of them, both palatally and in terms of the winemaking craft.
Yeah, I hope someday that I have enough money so I can fly first class to Germany during harvest and work a week with Klaus Peter Keller making Riesling. I want to make Riesling so bad. I want to make great Riesling so bad. The combination of spices and green apple and acid, and I love it. I mean, yeah, a great bottle of Trockenbaren Auslese makes the world a better place. I took my winemaking team to Vegas, and five of us sat down and drank 13 bottles of Riesling at Lotus of Siam for lunch. And because it's Riesling and all of it was Spätlese or sweeter, we were able to walk out and still be coherent. Yeah, no.
You treat people that surround you, that work for you, to those kinds of experiences, don't you? Very generous.
If they don't know great wine, how can they make great wine? We drink and play harder than most. I broke up my team this year. Part of the team is going with me to Honolulu for 5 days. Part of the team is going with me to New Orleans for 5 days. Everybody in the Bevan Cellars team went to New Orleans. First night we did Jose Andres Bizarre Meats and did this amazing dinner. Next day we did Lotus of Siam for lunch. The next day was Joel Robuchon for 8 courses. We had a blast. But if you can't play with the people you're working with, it makes life tougher. And if you don't elevate everybody's palate knowledge by drinking amazing, excellent wines together, you're never going to give them the tools to be the employees you want them to be. You got to drink great wine to make it.
Where does this come from? What I'm hearing you describe is a paternal relationship, both with your wines, because you shepherd them, you protect them, you used words like, I want to make sure they're safe and secure. You're a mentor to your staff and to your clients. What is the origin of that? Has there been an example in your early years that inspired you, or where did that value come from?
I like to play really hard. And I surround myself by people I care about, and it just makes it easy to want to go out and do all these things. And yeah, it's fun to be able just to go out and let your hair down and be as genuine as humanly possible with the people you're with all the time in a work environment and be able to do it away from work. I enjoy these people. I won't hire people I don't like.
Wow, living life to the fullest, how cool is that?
Rocks awful hard.
So we have neglected an area that's very near dear to your heart, which is biodynamics, and that also causes a lot of confusion in the consumer's minds. It's often used this term and not really backed up. I want to hear your perspective on it.
Okay, first of all, everybody needs the WenWine app. I have no vested interest in it. First thing I do every day is I WenWine app to see if it's a root, leaf, fruit, or flower day. I don't drink great wines on root days very often. I'll open a great bottle on a fruit day just because it's a fruit day. And that's just based on the barometric pressure. When it comes to farming, biodynamics I think are so incredibly important, and none of it has to do with any of the voodoo stuff that people love to talk about. Burying a horn full of poo or something else in your vineyard doesn't do anything for the vineyard at this point in time. But not adding chemicals to your vineyard does something for the vineyard. Taking your vineyard and having to spend the amount of time in it to do all of the treatments that biodynamics requires adds something to it. To farm biodynamically, you have to be on your site and spending time in it. You have to know it, and you're not adding horrible chemicals to it that are going to long-term take away the ecosystem that is a vineyard. And so I believe in biodynamics because I want to reduce chemicals used on a property, and I love being in the vineyard, and farming biodynamically puts you in your vineyard and it protects it from dangerous chemicals, and a lot of the nutrients we add are horrible. People are like, oh, your vineyard's biodynamic, so if the water runs off into the stream, that's okay. That's not okay. Because if you add so much compost, you're then going to have all that nitrogen going to the stream, and too much nitrogen in the stream is going to knock the stream's ecosystem off. There's more to being a good husband to the environment than just farming biodynamic or organic. And as much as I want to farm everything biodynamic, we're sitting here at Tench. I can't farm Tench biodynamic because I've got one neighbor over here who's got a horribly diseased vineyard, and there's a couple forms of bugs that live in this area that are going to jump from his property to my property. So I have to clear vegetation, and I have to use a few pesticides to kill these bugs to protect my financial investment. And it goes back to what I was saying earlier. If you're not honest and protective of the business, if you're not taking care of your business entity, you can't do anything else because you got to pay the bills.
Absolutely, and you're so aware of land being such a live partner in your world. Everything that you see permeates in that sense.
Great grapes come from living plants.
Yeah. So what's in store for the future of Bevan Sellers and Russell Bevan?
Right now that we've grown as much as we have, it's now solidifying ourselves until we go to the next step. You know, we're still looking at properties to purchase. If we could find the right piece of dirt for the right price, we'd love to continue to add assets. If you don't control your grape sources long term, your brand has no stability, and so we're looking at that. We just worked with Silverado Partners to plant 20 acres up on the mountain on top of southern Napa. And it's basically a giant rock pile. And so we've got this 20 acres coming online in the next year. And that's incredibly exciting. I just love driving up there and walking the property. So we're going to have some planned growth. But right now, we've grown so fast, we need to just take some time and stabilize everything and make sure that our base is still solid before we go on and make the next move.
Do you ever see yourself stepping away from land ownership, or will you forever be connected to the vineyard?
I would step away if at some point in time and we were older and we had to sell Bevan Cellars, or we decided to sell Bevan Cellars, because I'd want the brand to have continuity. I'd want the vineyards and the vineyard designates and the people's verticals to continue. But no, I certainly want to own land and be on the dirt, live on a vineyard that I own. Even if I'll make wine till I'm done. That there'll be a vintage in barrel the day I die.
You made your home in Sonoma, but you really spend the lion's share of your time in Napa, is that correct?
I do, but we also have a home in Yountville now, so I have a place literally 3 miles from here, so I can, I don't have a long commute every day.
You said the Napa future is bright. How so? And tell me about your overall perspective of what is your vision. You've watched the Valley now for 3 decades plus.
Well, you know, the big challenge right now is the cost of land. So I was talking earlier about how we have young, bright people here, but there's more bright young people on the Sonoma coast and in Sonoma County and going to El Dorado and Paso and Santa Rita and Santa Maria. Barriers to entry in Napa are so insanely high right now. There's so much extreme wealth wanting to be involved in Napa that buying a vineyard, getting a start like Victoria and I did, is going to be few and far between. You're going to have to find somebody who believes in you and wants to help you get started, unless you have a huge, huge bank account moving forward. Because there's so many people with so much money coming in, that's why I think so much of the Valley will end up being replanted, because these people are, you're not going to spend $1 million an acre and then make mediocre wine. You're going to demand excellence to meet your investment. At least I assume people would, if they've been successful enough in other industries to have the money to buy this land. They're going to want to do things that are special. That's why I think that there's going to be mass replanting, and we're going to fix row orientation and put drainage into vineyards that have heavier soils. And I think that the next quality wave is coming. And then I want to address global warming, because it's a huge issue. Mm-hmm. But you know, the technology to mitigate heat is out there. Up at Sentinel Ridge, we now have pulse misters in the vines. So instead of having misters in the vineyard for frost protection, up there we've got it to cool the fruit. So any day that it's over 96 degrees in the fruit zone, these pulse misters cool the vines down. Because normally when a vine gets above 96 or so, the vine will shut down and they won't produce flavors anymore. So we're putting the misters in to cool them, to keep the vine going 24 hours a day. We're using shade cloth to reduce late season UV penetration into the fruit zone to avoid shriveling. We're planting things with the right row orientation. So global warming's a concern, and I keep hearing people saying, oh, well, they're going to be growing Cabernet in Oregon soon. Well, that's garbage. That's not happening. But if you do have a warmer site in Napa, if you're up in Calistoga, you have to change your mindset to do things the right way. And all of those things are happening, and they're happening at a pretty quick rate. And so I think that with the improved science and improved farming techniques and how we know how to mitigate heat, I think that we're going to continue to see a big increase qualitatively in Napa. So the best days are in front of us. Global warming's a concern. The fires were horrendous, but we know how to manage the heat. And our dirt matches the base climate better than any place else, and that's why we make the best wines when we've got a good vintage.
So what you're saying is that rather than being emotional and sometimes even hysterical about it, take deliberate steps to address it, and there's a means to make it better, which is what you're looking for.
Absolutely. The world's not going to solve global warming anytime soon, and I'm a huge advocate for fighting climate change. But realistically, it's not happening anytime soon. The world's not going to change what it's doing. The super tankers that run on crude fuel that go from China to the United States that create more air pollution, those ships and all of our cars in a day, aren't going to change what they're using for fuel. The global warming issue is not going away anytime soon. So we need science to address it, and we need to be smart about what we do to offset and mitigate it.
If you had the ability to get the world to stop for 15 minutes and just listen to you, what would you want your message to be?
My politics are extremely liberal. I believe there's too many human beings on the planet. The carrying capacity has been exceeded. We need to start with just reducing overall pressures on the planet. And there's so much pressure on it that things like global warming are just going to continue to happen. But when a whale washed up in Monterey Bay with 50 pounds of plastic in its stomach the other day, and that's why it died, I mean, that there's just so many people creating so much pollution and garbage. It's horrific.
Well, I can see in your eyes that you really care, and that even though your home is in Napa Valley and you get to do beautiful things with your hands, challenging but beautiful, you're very acutely aware of the rest of the world and the bigger picture. In that spirit, I know you went to Jesuit College and you have very strong values that probably took root back then. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I loved utilitarianism when I was in school. John Stuart Mill was my favorite philosopher, and I just know that you can only have so much competition amongst people, races, religion, for so little land, and that's going to impact everything else. And we're just at a point in time where if people don't start making common sense decisions for the future, we're all in a world of hurt. The same thing with the U.S. government and taxing. We spend so much. The debt on future generations is going to be legend. They're going to be burdened with the interest payments on everything we're doing right now. And we have to stop spending money. I mean, people have to stop being so assertive that we're stealing from the next generations. Whether it's pollution, whether it's spending, the way we abuse the land.
If a young person is listening right now that's very attracted to the prospect of having a career in wine, what advice would you give them?
Drink a lot.
Then they need to be on your team.
Spend every dime you had. So I remember in 1997, Victoria and I, our combined incomes, I don't remember the exact amount, but it took our car payments, our rent, our power, our food bill, and we took everything together and we spent more money on wine than we did everything else. And so if you look at the concept of it takes 10,000 hours to master something, I was blessed that I had the best wine tasting group that a person could ever hope for. We drank the best wines in the world all the time, and I developed a palate by drinking, tasting, and you have to drink great wine to know how to make great wine, or you won't have the palate to do it.
Describe wine as a powerful teacher, clearly, and a mentor almost. There's a liquid mentor in this conversation that's very present.
And wine makes me more attractive and charming. So it's a thoughtful person can get so much out of a bottle of wine.
So I want to end on kind of the note of what value the wine brings to the table. And if there were to be an argument made about some of the most hedonistic wines that are produced in the New World, your name would pop up instantaneously. If I were to use one descriptor, that would be it, because you make wines that, as you described earlier, sensual and sexy, meaningful, age-worthy, yes. So you highlighted texture, you highlighted the relational aspect of wine. I want you to tell me what wine means to you.
A great bottle of wine gives like-minded people something fabulous to share, discuss, and participate in all at the same time. It makes your meal more enjoyable. The flavor profile and texture on a great wine is different than anything else you put in your mouth. And I think all of us are a little selfish. And each and every sip of a great wine I take, I'm being incredibly selfish. And I get so much pleasure out of it that it's something that I hope everybody else, well, everybody has something in their life that they get that much joy from. I just truly love nothing more than sitting with people I care about and drinking a great bottle of wine. That to me is about as good as it gets.
And do you believe in food and wine pairing, or is it contextual for you?
I do not need my food and wine to pair. I can.
Yes.
I am a bit of a foodie, a very small bit. I am a carnivore, and I like great wine, and I don't care if my food and wine match. I just want my wine to be excellent and my meat to be medium rare.
Well put, well put. So people can find your wine on your website. It's in distribution to Total Wine, as you've mentioned early in the conversation. So what can they expect if they sign up?
Well, we're going to give you as much bang for the buck as you get from anybody else. I make sure my name is on the bottle, that you're getting as much value from a bottle of Bevan as you can from anybody else. I won't disrespect your hard work and the effort you take to make money if you're going to spend it on a bottle of Bevan Cellars. Everything we make is expressive. We have big wines with big textures and flavors. Each bottle has a big old dose of love.
Beautiful. And it is possible to sign up for your list. It's not closed yet.
No, we're making new wines every year that we make available just to people that are new. And we make sure that everybody can get wines. Are some of them allocated to people that have been on the list? Certainly. But we always have wines that are available.
Well, that's good news, because I happen to know that your wines are not easy to come by. So going direct is really the way to go. And I know that every wine that winds up in somebody's hands would have a piece of your heart.
Yeah, I hope so. And thank you so very much for giving me all this time today, my dear.
Thank you, Russell. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure featuring Ilona Thompson. We'll see you again next week.